fill in some things and then try to get all of the, basically all the loose ends. And so, a few points. So, first of all, just to add a few thoughts about the fear idea. So, I've been collecting. I've been collecting other ideas about kfiya, and just among the interesting ideas is there's in the Sefer Elul Kofin Lahotzi. So he, in his introduction, he also talks about the themes of where his whole introduction really is about the Rambam, and he talks about, again, trying to figure out what the source is for the Rambam's idea, especially because, as one sefer noted, it's interesting that our sugya, Peches and Mibbeis, should really be where the Rambam expresses things, because where the Rambam comes from, because the idea that Get Musa is possible is from our Gemara, in Peches and Mibbeis, so it should say there what the story is in terms of why it sometimes works. So the Rambam throwing in there that it's because of the inner Pintali Yid, it's surprising that that doesn't find itself in our Gemara at all. So one possibility is, if you believe it's connected to the line Mitzvah Shmoa Devar Chachamim, so that appears in other places, so maybe it's from there, but as we noted, it's not so clear that that's actually the Rambam's position. It's not so clear that that's what that Gemara means. It's not so clear that's what the Rambam means. So the Rambam's whole idea of the Pintel Yid, where does that come from? And in the Sefer, Elul Kofin Lahotzi is a very beautiful Sefer. I have it here by Rabbi Yosef Goldberg, who the whole Sefer is about the Inyanim of Kfiya, but because the Rambam's position is so central, so he has two introductions. He has a Hakdama and a Mavo. So in the Hakdama, he talks more hashkafically about the Rambam. And in the Mavo, he talks more lamdish-wise about the Rambam's position. So he discusses there that in the Mavo, in the more hashkafic piece, he says the Rambam is making two separate points. Right? One point is that the inner Jew always wants to do the right thing. And the other point is that he stopped from doing the right thing by the Yetzer. So each one really could have its own marker. So the idea that he stopped from the Yetzer, so that he points to a Gemara in Kedusha on Daf Lamed, a pretty well-known Gemara, where the Gemara contains that line that HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, Barasi Yetzer, V'barasi Torah Tavlin. And I've created the Yetzer, and I also created the Torah as the remedy. And therefore, good advice for you, you should involve yourself in Torah, and in doing so, iatanim sarim biyado, you won't be turned over into its hands. So, the idea seems to be that this is a force that could come and get you, and the Gemara quotes the pasuk in Parshas Bereishis, lapetach chatas rovetz, the sin crouches at the door. By David Foreman wrote a book with that title, if something like that. It's in there, the beast that crouches at the door. So that's, in general, actually, those psukim maybe are a little bit contradictory to this, because the pasuk talks about the Yetzer Hara being always threatening, but also some of the lines there about Ki Yetzer Lev HaAdam Ra Min Urav seems to maybe contradict the Pintel Yid, although it's before Matan Torah, so maybe it's not a contradiction, maybe it's just saying humanity is created on a different default, and then Matan Torah brings it to a different level. But in any event, so that idea of the Yetzer Hara is always out there waiting to get you, and you have to learn Torah in order to thwart it, so that may be one Talmudic source for that second part of it, that the Yetzer Hara is trapping you. And then he goes back to the Gemara in Shabbos, and I may be reformulating this, but either way, take it either as his or as mine with the spin. I think this is basically what he's saying. That you recall the Gemara in Shabbos about Kafu Leim Hayar Kigigas. So the central stira there is, the inescapable stira, because it's right there on the page, is what about Nasa v'Nishma? So here we declared that we are eager to accept the Torah. And then we said, in the same Gemara, on the same page where we're praised for that, the Gemara says that we were forced to accept the Torah. So that's a pretty blatant contradiction, and there are a number of possible suggestions. We focused mostly on the Tanchuma, that it's about Torah Shebichsav and Torah Shebalpeh. But Tosfos on the page talks about it, and Tosfos asks, what about Nasa v'Nishma? And says, no, they accepted it willingly, but they were worried, the concern was that maybe they would then go back on it. So the kfiyah was to make it irreversible. So kind of building off that idea, he suggests that maybe that's the nature of things. That really, yes, if we were forced to accept the Torah, so then that seems to undermine the Pintaliyah, like the Chasam Sofer and others asked. Right? And like the Tosfos, like the Gemara says about Modar Rabba L'Araisa, doesn't that mean that we may be able to argue we have an excuse to not keep the whole Torah? It was all forced upon us. So, rather, what you could say is that it's not that it was forced upon us to begin with. We accepted it willingly. But there was the concern that then the Yetzer Hara comes in and we may let it go. We may drop it. So the purpose of the kfiyah was, like Tosfos was indicating, to keep us on the straight and narrow. So if that's what's going on, so then that really parallels the Rambam pretty well. Because how do we know there's a Pintaliyah? Because we jumped in to accept the Torah. We said Nasa v'Nishma. Nasa v'Nishma is the source of the Pintaliyah, is the indication that Pintaliyah is there. And how do we know, and therefore, that it's the Yetzer Hara that we're worried about? Because that's the concern. That's the concern then, that, okay, they're all revved up now, but maybe when things get difficult, so then maybe they're going to lose their commitment. So therefore, there needs to be this locking down of the obligation. So that really does parallel pretty well the two halves of the picture here, that there's an inner yid that wants to do the right thing, but other things can get in the way, and therefore we need to have an enforcement policy, and that's what the kfiyah represents. So in that sense, you know, unlike some of the earlier Sfarim, like Chasam Sofer, maybe most prominently, and a while ago we mentioned the Chen Shlomo, who had a whole different spin on the Gemara because of the kashas that emerged from it. So the different challenges that come from engaging with Shabbos Daf Pei Ches and Beis and the Rambam's Yisod. So this is a pretty elegant way of approaching it, that essentially it matches both halves of what the Rambam was saying. So as far as how it shows up in practice, so a couple of interesting points. So one is, I saw in a sefer that is available in Hebrew books called Ezra's Nashim, actually, and it was written by an author named Meir HaMeiri, talking more about Inyanim of Nashim, not about the shul. But so he discusses there the fact that Chalitza and Yibum are basically opposites of each other in terms of the requirement for intentionality. And that Chalitza is a whole discussion, what kind of kavanah you need for Chalitza, but that's an involved sugya. And Yibum basically doesn't really need any kavanah at all, that a man just begins life with his sister-in-law, and he's in fulfillment of Yibum. And the whole idea that there's even any kind of a chuppah, there's even any kind of a ceremony, that's midrabanan. So they're kind of opposites as far as Kavanah is concerned. So he suggests that this is also because of the Rambam, essentially, that we assume that you always want to do the right thing. And when it comes to Yibum and Chalitza, so it's a difficult part of the whole Chalitza thing, because in real life, unfortunately, when it comes up, Rahman al-Islam, it comes up, you know, by its nature under tragic circumstances, and it's a very emotionally difficult kind of mitzvah. And it's especially difficult because the way the Torah describes it, it's supposed to be kind of a excoriation of the brother-in-law because he's not fulfilling his obligation of Yibum. Now it's additionally awkward and difficult because no one b'zman hazeh really has the option of fulfilling yibum. The assumption is, at least among the Ashkenazim, that we don't actually allow yibum to be performed. So we're kind of giving this guy a mussar shmooz for something he didn't have a choice about anyway, but it's all a part of upholding the value, and the value of yibum, as the Maram Shik talks about in his commentary to Chumash, is a very deep yesodos that are contained within it. It's not for now, but for now, just to emphasize the point that yibum is really the Torah's ideal, and chalitza is if you're refusing to do the mitzvah of yibum. So he connects that to the idea that if indeed the whole purpose is that the whole theme is that we assume you always want to do the right thing, so yibum being the default preference, so then that doesn't need any kind of kavana because that's what the Torah wants. While chalitza, being that that is essentially refusing to do what the Torah wants, and then that's the release, so therefore that requires the intent to move it away from the notion of of the yibum that was the default preference. Yeah.
But how does that fit into those who say like mitzvos, shrikin, kavanah?
So different mitzvos have different requirements to them. And what that means is actually its own sugya. It's an important question, and it has some kind of connection to it. But we see already that we're talking about things like kiddushin and sales and gittin, that our level of intentionality is different. Now, it's true, it's an important question. Is there any connection at all to this about general mitzvos? And a number of achronim thought that yes, that the Gemara that says, at least according to one opinion, that if you're forced to eat matzah, you're yotzei the mitzvah, that that's also because of the Rambam. So there might be some relation to it. So, but it's going in that direction. It may, so this sugya may inform something about the sugya mitzvah shrichas kavana. Mitzvah shrichas kavana is more separate from these issues of these kind of kinyanim and relationships, which would exist with or without it. So the way in which this comes up in other mitzvahs, we talked about a little bit, but just to expand upon it, so we mentioned in the context of Mechiras Chametz, you might recall, we talked about the supermarkets and about the whole question of is there any validity when somebody is otherwise not religious or otherwise not aware of what's going on. So can we assume that the kinyan is good at least for that purpose? And there were some who point to the Rambam to make that point. The Chalkas Yaakov, for example, in his Chuvas, he was a big advocate of this. And he writes that it's a Kavachomer from Gerushin, because look here, if it works by Gerushin, so here the stakes, in Gerushin, the stakes are very high, a point that we emphasized from the beginning, or you couldn't really have higher stakes, because we're talking about Mamzeris and Isher Eishus Ish, so the stakes are as high as anything else in Halacha. And yet, it works because of the Pintaliyad, according to the Rambam. And there, the guy is screaming, he's not interested. So if you compare that to Mechiras Chametz, let's say, where we just don't know how serious the parties are, so there the stakes are not as high as Gittin. And he hasn't declared that he's not interested. So all the more so, you should say that it should work. Now, he does note, but in the context of Gittin, the Rambam does require, not always shown him agreed, but the Rambam does require Rotsani. You do have to say Rotsani. So, if that's the case, so then, why maybe we should require that by the Mechiras Chametz and the like, if we're, let's say, getting people involved without their knowledge, which is the whole discussion. So, maybe not, because maybe you'll need Rotsani to contradict when the person has says he doesn't want to. So, because there the person is actually being coerced, and he was saying he's not interested, so then we need the Rotsani to cancel that out. But maybe we don't need Rotsani in other areas. So in addition to Mechiras Chametz, it comes up in the context of Heter Iska. I remember if we spoke about that so much, that'll be next week's Parsha, so a little bit of an advance on next week's Parsha, where the prohibition of Ribbis comes up. So just to say a sentence about this, the Torah forbids lending money with interest, And Bizman Hazah, in order to address the situation that people need to provide funds to others for business purposes, which maybe is different than what the Torah was addressing when it said don't charge interest when you help people out with loans. So in order to address the letter of the law of that, so we have a heter iska, which reformulates the transaction. Instead of a loan, it's an investment. And instead of interest, you're getting returns on the investment. So there's a whole literature. What if one part or the other doesn't know about what's going on or doesn't care, isn't religious enough to care about what's going on? So there again, the Chelkas Yaakov says, you can look to the Rambam's Pintaliyid, and that will allow it to be considered effective. And again, he says, maybe it's a Kal Vachomer from Gerushin. And says that Heter Iska could be a Kal Vachomer from Mechiras Chametz. Because Mechiras Chametz, there is a non-Jew involved also, and we need to make his transaction count. And he doesn't have a Pintaliyid. And yet we're still assuming that this is effective. So when it comes to the Heter Iska, by definition, both parties are Jewish. So that's a Kal Vachomer from Mechiras Chametz. It says that if it works by Gerish, then all the more so it should work for Mechiras Chametz, and all the more so it should work for the Heter Iska. So it was also a very interesting discussion historically about 100 years ago. Rabbi Yisrael Eger, who was a grandson of Rabbi Leibel Eger, who himself was a grandson of Rabbi Akiva Eger. So, great-great-grandson of Rabbi Akiva Eger, Yisrael Eger, lived in Warsaw about 100 years ago, so around the early 1920s, this happened. So he made a proposal that so the Heter Iska is a specific arrangement between two people in the context of a given loan. But sometimes people don't even remember to do that. So in order to try to reduce sin even further, what we should do is we should have a suggestion that everyone, once in their lifetime, they should put up on their wall, they should make a Heter Iska klal list. They should make a declaration that every transaction that I ever get involved in that looks like a loan is actually under the understanding of Heter Iska. And that way we'll save a lot of people from sin. So it was a fascinating discussion. You could actually read all the back and forth if you ever want to research this topic. It's quite interesting. And it was originally published in a journal called Drushim, which was a journal of Polish rabbis back then, 100 years ago. So he made this suggestion of Yisrael Eger, and there was 10 or 12 responses, some for, pro, and some against. And then the next issue, there was another whole set of responses. And then a few years later, he wrote a whole volume about it called Tekanas Rabim, and there was a whole back and forth there. So there's a whole discussion, this whole suggestion about the Heter Iska Klalis. Is this a good idea? Is this a bad idea? Will this help? Will this hurt? Some said maybe it's better to do it once a year instead of once a lifetime. We should do it together with Mecheres Chametz. We should do it together with Kol Nidre. Various suggestions about whether this is a good idea, will it help, will it make things worse. So, as part of his original presentation of Yisrael Eger, so he writes there that, listen, obviously this is not ideal. And it would be better if you wrote a specific Heter Iska in every instance. But sometimes people forget. So, therefore, this is a better catch-all so that just in case people forget or people are unaware, or people just are clueless, so then this will be the default position. And if you remember and you want to do things seriously, so then yes, there should be a specific Heter Iska in every case. But having this backup Heter Iska clawless will serve somewhat of a purpose. There's a whole discussion also, but then what if the other party doesn't have it? So then does it still work? Or maybe his suggestion was that get everyone to do it, so therefore we may let always be both sides have this understanding. So that was a whole back and forth. There's a lot of literature about this, really quite interesting to read it. But in that very first presentation, so Rabbi Yisrael Eger, he talks about the Rambam and about Gerushin. And he says that the way he relates to it, it's slightly different from how it's being applied in some of these other sources. He says that here, what's the kind of scenario? You have somebody who, in general, already he's established he wants to do the right thing because he is writing this heteristic qualis. So there is at least one point in his life where he's showing that he does want to do things the proper way. But he may forget, he may not be paying attention during his transactions. So his application is that's really what the Rambam's talking about. The Rambam's talking about somebody who has expressed that this is essentially what he wants to be and where he wants to associate, but he can drift away and he can forget. So even if you forget, but the neshama doesn't forget. Because the pintli yid remembers who it wants to be. The inner neshama, that stays in touch. So that's exactly the scenario that we need here. So this is for people when they forget or get distracted. And that's where the Rambam describes his formulation, that it's there in order to be the backup if you forget. So it was itself a very fascinating presentation. And that has its own implications. So this is all interesting, all of this literature that applies it in the context of Heteriska, Mechiras Chameitz, and maybe a little bit in the context of Heter Mechira as well. It's a little harder to find, but theoretically you could have that type of understanding also. And there is a little bit of a contrast, because you may recall that we talked about at the time that some of the Rishonim already said, well, what about a mishumet? If you have somebody who has abandoned Judaism, so how does kfiyah work then? If the Rambam is based on a pintel yid, so if somebody is not religious, doesn't want anymore to be a part of the Jewish people, so then maybe you can't be kofa, and that would be pretty hard to imagine. So the Maharik raised this issue, or somebody else raised it to him, because in the response to a letter that his tshuva is responding to someone else, and he says to the correspondent, he says, Yofa Dikdakta, that's a good point that you made about the Rambam, that what would he say about the Mishumid? So he says, Taka, it's a problem. Yeah.
Would there be different categories within a Mishumid, as in someone who was from and then actively decided to leave the community versus someone who was raised in a, let's say, a conservative or a forum community? Would they be considered mishumet the same way because they never actively left Judaism behind?
Well, the question is it the leaving or is it the not being there? So is it about where you were or is it about where you're at right now? If a person, it's also interesting because the language that gets used somewhat interchangeably, but it's not really a perfect synonym, is Mishumud and Mummer. So Mummer sometimes gets thrown in here in some of the literature, but it's not a perfect synonym, because a Mishumud we use to mean a convert, so somebody who has actively said he wants to be a part of a different religion. So then it's really a good question, can you say that he really wants to be part of the Jewish people and to do mitzvahs? Now, there were those who said, why not? The same way that we say he really wants to give a get, we could say he really doesn't want to leave Judaism. But on the surface, it seems like he does. So a mummer is somebody who has ignored either a part or all of halacha, but that could be more complicated, and that could be that he's just motivated already. We distinguish between a mummer l'teyavon and a mummer l'hachas. You know, there are people who ignore halacha because they just have a great desire for whatever aveira it is. So that doesn't necessarily match up. So when you use a mummer, it becomes a little bit more complicated. And there certainly are more nuances. But as far as mishumet, so that's a little bit of a cleaner case, so to speak. Question about that?
So is there an idea that if they're signing heteriska, if they're handing over the get, or if they're selling chametz, they're not full on mishumet, otherwise they would not do it at all, like they would never do these things if they were so against Judaism, like I believe in blank now, and I feel like I'd be disrespecting my new deity if I were to sign this heteriska, like how, you know, so.
Maybe, maybe not. See, it's also because we're kind of mixing the areas. So the
someone converts out. You know?
Right. So the issue of Mishumad was brought up in the context of Kviya Baget. So there he's not signing anything. Right? Yeah. They're just showing up at his house and saying, you better divorce his wife. Better divorce your wife. And he says, I'm uninterested. And they say, well, too bad. And the Rambam said that it worked because of the Pintaliyah. So the Marik and others said, well, maybe there's a Pintaliyah when somebody generally keeps the Torah, and here's the one place he doesn't, so you can say, okay, we know that he wants to do the right thing, so it's considered to be Beratzon. But what if somebody has abandoned completely? So the Marik suggested, back to his correspondent, that maybe this works some way differently. Maybe this is Afgenu, that Chazal canceled out this marriage because of Iguna, otherwise this Kanush is going to be trapped forever. So in general, Kofin may work like the Rambam, but here it's going to be a different story. And there were others who said, Taka, Marit Salon wrote that, yeah, there's no Eitzah for a Meshumad, because we can't rely on the Pintaliyah, according to the Rambam. And then there was still a third view that said, no, you don't have to assume that the Pintaliyah leaves, and the same way we can bring out the Pintaliyah in this one area of Git, and we can bring it out in other areas also. So it's particularly noteworthy that there you had these Rishonim already saying even the Rambam's Mechudishtik expansive idea still should be limited to people who in general have some commitment to Halacha, while here in the context of Mechiras Chametz and Hatzah Mechira, the assumption is no, that even those who are not observant at all and who are displaying in general sinful behavior, still is a Pintaliyah there, and we can activate that. Hi.
If the Meshumad wanted to come back, would he have to go through a Falgeiris process?
So that's also an interesting discussion.
If the answer is yes, then Mestama, while he is a Meshumad, there is no Pintaliyah, but if he doesn't have to go through a Geiris process, then he's just coming back, so it was there.
You know, it's an interesting question because it puts a very mystical spin, even more mystical spin, on the Pintaliyah idea. But that itself is at the core of the question. So, Lamaista, we assume that you cannot convert out of Judaism. And we say, the Gemara says that Yisrael afal pishachati Yisrael. And some say that that actually is connected to the Rambam. That may be a source for the Rambam. But, so it's a little circular. Let's come back to that. But, so when a person converts out of Judaism, it's kind of like owning chametz or intermarriage, that the Aveira is in trying to do it rather than actually there being a reality to it. So, Avraham Lichtenstein, Zichzav Lebrach, had a fascinating article many years ago when there was a whole controversy about a Franciscan monk who wanted to come back to Israel under the law of return because he was born Jewish. So, I don't remember the details, maybe he had Jewish motherhood. But the discussion of, is it ever possible to get so immersed in another culture that you actually do stop being Jewish, is a question. But on the surface, technically, we don't recognize conversion out of Judaism. So if that's the case, so then it doesn't seem like that's what would be turning off the Pintaliyah. There is a notion of a kind of a Geiris Drabanan that we may impose. We may say that somebody who comes back from Shemad should go to the mikvah, and it's a question whether that's supposed to be a Geiris, like a Drabanan kind of Geiris, or maybe an act of tshuva. It's not really connected to Geiris. So saying that the Pintaliyah gets turned off is not because he stops being Jewish. It's because if we assume that there's somewhat more of a rational model of the Pintaliyah, that we're saying that he, deep down, really does want, not just because of any kind of mystical neshama, but because really that's where, if you really were to bring it out, so then you'd see that that was the... I remember reading about a biography of a prominent person who had converted out of Judaism. And then at the end of his life, he was sick and he was having a heart attack and he had surgery. And he survived the first surgery and he died later. And then I remember the book saying that after that first surgery, he said, it'll take more than that to kill this old Jew. And the point being that, yes, he had converted for whatever reason he converted, but deep down he still knew he was a Jew. So maybe that's what we mean, that literally, that no matter what you're doing, but really, really push comes to shove, you still know you're Jewish. So is that what's activating it, or is it something completely mystical?
Someone who's a textbook Kofir Apikoros?
So it could be that we still... Now, the question is, what is a textbook Kofir Apikoros? That's itself a question. And that was a little bit... relevant to the last week's parsha, the question of where does Avos Yisrael begin and end? But the Chazon Ish, a fascinating comment. A few years ago, we were learning Chulin here, so we actually had the opportunity to go through this in more detail because it comes up in Hilchos Shchita. But the way the Chazon Ish writes, to be a real kofer, you have to deny Nisim Guyim. Means that we haven't had one since Bayashen. So we're not round the Madrega to be a kofer, basically. So it's the point, it's been said about somebody, it's too much of a maritz to be an apikoros. You have to be in a Madrega to be an apikoros. You can't just rebel against nothing. You have to really know and rebel. So is anybody on the level to be a real? So how exactly define these categories is itself very interesting. But it just seems like there's a disconnect here, that the earlier Svarim commenting on the Rambam were saying that, well, maybe it should be limited only to religious people. And these poskim who were expanding it were saying that, oh, even less religious people or non-religious people could also benefit from this understanding, and it would be applied to them also. And Zviel Eger, whose whole motive was to try to save as much of Klal Yisrael as possible, but he still had a little bit more of a limited understanding. He's saying that really the ideal template here is somebody who at least at one point says, okay, sign me up for the Hatteristic Kwalas. And then after that, he turns off, perhaps, but then you can go back to that initial memory, and that's what the Rambam was discussing when he made his comments. It's yet another fascinating application. The Radbaz, to go again to earlier sources, the Radbaz in a few chuvas, so he works off the Rambam's premise, and one context that's outside of Gittin completely, so he talked about somebody, let's say he was a teacher, somebody within a religious function, and he took a neder not to ever go back to that profession, but he was forced to. He was forced to take a neder not to go back to this profession. And apparently he accepted upon himself, if he would do that, he would be taking on a Nazir Shimshin, which is unreversible, with no hatara for Nazir Shimshin. So the question was, should we say, well, it was under duress, so therefore it shouldn't count. So his commitment not to take on, not to return to this job, should be considered coerced. So the Radbaz says, well, it depends. Maybe there was a good reason why they did this, why they made him take this commitment. Maybe because he had some moral disqualification for the position or something such as that. And therefore, maybe he was actually religiously unsuited for that job. So then, he says, the Rambam would tell you that, therefore, the right thing to do is indeed for him not to go back to this position. And if that's the case, so then we should say that it's not considered coerced. That when he took an oath not to go back to that position, it was willing because that was indeed what he was supposed to do. And therefore, it's effective. A fascinating application. So, a lot more to say about this. We're almost out of time. I just want to mention, so I read with you Rabbi Bleich's discussion about the whole prenup situation. Just, it'll just take 2 minutes, and we'll just to tell you what he says instead of reading it all inside, so we can preserve a little more space for the next 2 days. But his version of the prenup, you recall how we discussed how it worked, where there's an obligation that one takes on to support his wife if they are living apart. And that level of support is going to be at a high level, and therefore the husband will divorce so that he shouldn't have to pay that. So Rabbi Bleich was among those who were concerned that that constitutes an asmachta, that that constitutes a commitment that you don't think is ever really going to happen, and therefore when it does happen, it's really not willing, and so essentially you're being robbed at gunpoint, so any get that would come out of that would be questionable. So, yeah.
In what case, a get musa?
There would be a get musa because, or close to it at least, if not actually get musa, because the husband, even if he committed to this arrangement, that if they're living apart, he's going to take on this extra commitment of support, but that he never thought was really going to happen. So, therefore, that's an asmachta, and it's not a genuine commitment.
Same thing by, like, gambling?
Related to the concept by gambling. So the idea that the Gemara says the apostle aids if you collect from gambling, that's because the loser didn't think he was going to lose. The same idea. So here, so Reb Leif's version is different, and it has its pluses and minuses to it, but what he recommended was that the husband, at the time of marriage, should accept a very inflated level of mizonos. That he should accept the obligation of support. You can make your mizonos anything you want. He brings a raya, as we saw, we're reading inside. He brings a raya from Rivka, that Rivka said she had these animals that Yitzchak had given her for her ksuba, and it was clearly much more than what a normal person needs to have for daily sustenance. So you see that it's valid if a husband were to decide, okay, when I want to get married, I'm so in love with my wife, I'm going to take on a huge obligation that's not standard, so then that's binding. So he should take on a big obligation of support. And the advantage for asmachta purposes is that it takes place right away. Now, it ends with the declaration that that if they're living apart and he declares he'll give a get, that's when it ends. So he's motivated to give the get because he can't afford to pay this much when they're not married. But the asmachta solution that he had is that it doesn't wait till then to be relevant. It's relevant right away. As soon as they get married, this obligation of mizonos kicks in. So then there's no claim that, oh, I never thought it was going to happen. It happens no matter what. It happens immediately. So how does the marriage last? So then they can't afford to stay married under any circumstance. So to that, it says that, first of all, the wife, it's not in her interest to claim that money, because if she has an interest in staying married, so then she's not going to want to demand such a high support that her husband can't afford to stay married to her. So, therefore, the assumption is that kol zman, that they're happily married, she will be mochel, this daily obligation, or that she'll take the standard support that every normal marriage involves, she'll take that instead, in lieu of that high level of support. But the crucial part of the puzzle for him is that it's not contingent on anything happening. So there's no asmachta element that the husband could say, oh, I signed this, yeah, because I thought it was never going to happen. So no, it happens immediately. You committed yourself right away to this level of support. From day one of the marriage, you're obligated in it. It's just that every day she's mochel, because otherwise she recognizes that he's not going to stay married to her. So as long as she wants to stay married to him, she's mochel this big support. But once they're apart, then it becomes relevant again. Now, he acknowledges also that that could be misused, so she could just use that to extort him. So then it has to be that as soon as he's ready to give the get, if she refuses, so then it's still going to be canceled. But as long as everything else is in place, then that's going to remain the obligation. So it's essentially his way of addressing the asmachta. The BDA uses the way we discussed. They have other reasons why they think that's preferable. So, elu v'elu. Yeah.
I was going to ask, why not use that version?
So there are other, maybe we'll go into that a little bit more tomorrow, because I just want to say a few minutes, but that there may be downsides to that version as well. But as far as also getting the whole commitment to begin with, but that was essentially related to the whole asmachta question, whether you feel that it's asmachta to begin with. Okay, so do we have a volunteer for mincha?